This is an ABC podcast.
Well, tomorrow, Victoria goes to the polls. And as the editorial in The Age today says, it's a contest between the arrogant and the unprepared.
A vote for Labor is a vote to cut your bills.
Don't wake up on Sunday with a Daniel Andrews hangover.
You're with Andy Park. This is RN Drive for a Friday. Thanks for joining me. A top-rate selection of commentators to chew over this weekend's election and more. The host of Frankly, Fran Kelly, and former ABC Radio Melbourne host John Fain will together pick apart the issues that are foremost on Victorians' minds in just a moment, but also the national legislative issues affecting the whole country, such as the Bell Report into the Morrison Ministries, which we had a peek at today for the first time. In fact, the former Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, has broken his silence too about the issue of these ministries. And the National Integrity Commission bill now heads to the Senate after passing in the lower house. Lots to talk about this week. Also, will you be watching the Socceroos tomorrow night as they face off against Tunisia in a must-win match at the Qatar World Cup? A preview of what you're likely to expect. We'll cross to Doha shortly. And it's an all-star quiz tonight in the RN Drive Friday Quiz.
Hi, I'm writer, actor and broadcaster Veronica Milsom, and my special subject is Paw Patrol and definitely not the news.
G'day, I'm author, podcaster and occasional federal candidate Alex Dyson, and my special subject is dance floor ecology.
Yeah, that's the RN Drive Friday quiz coming your way shortly. And stick around after 7 o'clock tonight, an emotional chat with The Seeker's Keith Potka. They've actually found some new recordings with the late, great Judith Durham. You'll get a taste later on in the drawing room after 7. Join the conversation. Text me 0418226576 on any of the conversations we're having tonight. Across Australia, you're with Andy Park, and this is RN Drive. Well, it's do or die for the Socceroos tomorrow as they face Tunisia in a must-win match at the Qatar World Cup. Australia could still make the knockout stage of the tournament if they get at least a win and a draw from their remaining matches and, of course, with other results going their way. Freelance football writer and fan Christian Bullock is on the ground in Doha. Good morning to you, Christian. How are the Aussies feeling ahead of the match?
I would say optimistic. Look, there's a lot of importance for this match. We haven't won a World Cup match in 12 years now, so I think both the fans and the players understand just how important 3 points is against Tunisia, both in terms of the group, but also in terms of the long wait that we've had.
And do you want to see any changes to the starting 11?
I think there is appetite for changes. Personally, I believe that the team that played against France is probably better suited to a team like Tunisia with players like Nathaniel Atkinson and Lekin Goodwin, who are very attacking. It'll be interesting to see how they play when they've got a little bit more freedom playing against the Tunisians compared to the French. So I'm excited to see how they go.
And what did you think of the timing of the subs in our loss to France? And should we be giving more minutes to our younger players to kind of get them up to speed quicker?
I think it's an interesting question. Kind of watching the impact of the players that came on, especially Garang Kuol. It's a tough assignment first up against the world champions, you know, for our young players to kind of come in and really have an influence on the game. I think they struggled to do so, which is understandable. It's an incredibly tough opponent. I would like to see these younger players brought on for longer minutes against games like Tunisia and Denmark, where, you know, they'll have a greater influence, but also they can bring a bit more energy, which I think at times we were really lacking against the French.
And of course, win, lose or draw tomorrow night, our time, that goal by Craig Goodwin against France, how did it feel to be watching it live in the stadium?
It's a moment in time, isn't it? To be, you know, back at, what was it then, 10:09 p.m. Doha time. It was a pretty magical moment. It was interesting because heading into the stadium, a lot of the neutrals were all supporting the world champions, which is completely understandable. So there was only a little pocket of Australian supporters, but God, we made some noise when that goal went in. That was It was just outstanding. I think you could probably see on the TV, tucked in that little left corner, the pocket of green and gold. It was an outstanding moment, you know, to be back there.
That said, though, we have seen a few empty seats on the TV. Is that what it feels like in the stadiums? Are you seeing vast sections that are just completely empty?
Yes, it's an interesting one. I've found for both Australia games, but also just across the tournament, I've been to a number of games now, and getting tickets to matches has been surprisingly easy. I imagine as well, after that first up loss for the hosts, Qatar, a lot of matches became easy to get tickets for on the resale, people selling their tickets and deciding not to go. So it's interesting to see. It's interesting for you to ask that question, because the engagement from the host nation I found has been quite low. So I'm not surprised that there are a few empty seats.
Soccer is tragic. Christian Bullock is here. We're talking about the World Cup on RN Drive. You're with Andy Park. And when you're not at these matches, what are you getting up to in Qatar? I mean, the fan zones have gotten some media attention, certainly the lack of full-strength beer in some venues. So what do you get up to?
Well, for me, it's the market. I think any Middle Eastern country, you hear a lot about the different spice markets and, road markets. And for me, that's been the highlight, definitely. When you kind of leave all of the flashy, designer stores that you see in Doha that they love to advertise, and you head into the real nitty-gritty old part of the city, it's just absolutely stunning.
Of course, we can't talk about this World Cup without the criticism about the host country's human rights record. How is Qatar handling these issues during the tournament? I mean, what are you seeing on the ground?
Well, the discussion was always that once the football started, that a lot of that would die down. And it's interesting because people understand the context. Fans here understand the context. It's a difficult way to kind of explain your experience, to head to these lavish buildings and stadiums that are the most stunning structures you've ever seen before. And to really describe it to people who aren't there, it's quite difficult because you understand the context, you understand how egregious the whole process of this World Cup has been in terms of the construction, but also the right to host it. So I think a lot of people, not keeping their mouth shut in a way, but I don't know how else to describe it.
Well, we certainly, for the players, in terms of their activism, we saw the sort of coverage about the armbands, rainbow-striped armbands, those not being allowed on the pitch. I mean, these sorts of issues get talked about amongst the many nations and their supporters who are attending this World Cup.
Definitely. Not publicly. You wouldn't, hear people shout it out loud, in front of a crowd of people, but amongst supporters, and even when you speak to people from different nations, it is, it's quite a hot topic, definitely. And there was also the protest from the German national team as well.
An extraordinary moment, wasn't it? How was that received? I mean, were people cheering them on in the stadiums or?
Well, actually, a lot of people at the time didn't really understand what the movement was for. Like it was very much explained on the TV coverage, but once the conversation came out, it was all anyone was talking about here in Doha after that Germany-Japan match.
We know it's a very compact tournament based in one quite small country. You've experienced the very crowded fan zone yourself. Have you been able to attend multiple matches on one day, or has it been too crowded?
No, absolutely. I've been in Doha now for about 6 days, and the tournament's been going for about 5 days now, and I've attended 8 matches, and most of those 2 games a day or 3 games a day, which is pretty unique. I've been to World Cups before, and to go to 1 match at a World Cup, you're seen as pretty lucky. If you go to 3 matches, you're incredibly lucky, but there are people here who have tickets to 15, 18 just in the group stage alone. So in that sense, it's incredibly different to anything we've ever known. And it's one little positive, I think, to the idea of a compact World Cup.
Well, the nation certainly here back in Australia will be watching tomorrow night, 9 p.m. when the Socceroos take on Tunisia. Christian Bullock will be there. He's a freelance football writer. Thanks for your time tonight.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to RN Drive. I'm Andy Park. Time for the Friday quiz.
Let's get quizzical!
Yes, it is Friday. In fact, it's the last Friday of November. And do you know what that means? In our house, it's the weekend that you're allowed to start putting up Christmas decorations. Of course, all the shopping centres have done it for the last 6 months. But before we head off into the weekend, we're bringing back two OGs to the Friday quiz this week to squeeze out some laughs from the week that was. First up. She's bringing some big boomer energy in. She's the podcasting queen who's looking to stitch up our wasteful ways. Please put your hands together, clap at your radio and internet streams. It is Veronica Milsom.
Hey, that was my pump-up song during the whole of lockdown. We would play it every single day, our family, and just dance in the kitchen.
Is it the song that you do CPR to, or that's Staying Alive?
Yeah, that's Staying Alive. Uh-huh. But I reckon people don't know that. It's one of the Bee Gees' quiet classics.
You win again. Mm. A harbinger of things to come, perhaps also in the Friday quiz tonight. Yes, he's the man who almost pulled off a bit of magic at the last federal election, but he's turned his life, well, around, really. He's repented for those sins, returning to broadcasting, writing, and, of course, he's the comedy baron, Alex Dyson.
G'day there. I do hope the laughs are flowing like a fountain today and we're not having to squeeze them like blood from a stone. Hopefully they're flowing freely, yes.
I'll be the judge of that. Now, V, you're in between, well, you've got a lot of podcasts, don't you? How many podcasts have you got now?
Yeah,
can you check your wallet? How many podcasts have you got?
I'm not as many as Mark Fennell, but I'm working towards it. He's Mr. Podcast.
Actually, I want to ask you about Reef School.
Oh, yeah.
So how does this work? You pretend to be a manta ray and go inside the mind of a manta ray and give it a voice.
So, I mean, Reef School isn't one of my podcasts. It's one of my TV shows. Which is fun. So this is for ABC Kids. It came out just last week. Emma Wiggle is the narrator. Tony Armstrong, everyone's favourite guy. He's the lead turtle. And it's
the lead turtle.
Yeah, turtle.
What do you play? The manta ray? No.
I play just like whatever I want, additional characters. I couldn't get any lead roles despite having written the entire thing.
Are you like...
So you're a marinara of characters, there, Veronica.
Sure.
Are you like in the school play, you're the tree or you're the coral in the background like this?
Exactly, swaying there gently. it's such a fun show. If you haven't seen it yet, look at it on iView. It's for preschoolers. I'll just give you a heads up.
That's all we watch in our house these days.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, 3 to 6 year olds. If that's you and you're listening, you'll be into it.
I'm guaranteeing that I will watch it so much that I hate it.
Yeah.
Like Frozen or anything else that we watch in our house. And Alex, amongst your podcasting and electioneering, I understand you've returned from the US of A. You went to some pretty nice places, Grand Canyon National Park. Although, what did you find in this hot, dry, and dusty place?
I tell you what, the red rocks of Arizona mystically disappeared as I rolled in with my little camper van to the Grand Canyon. It was snowing when I got there. Mm. Fog everywhere. Couldn't see the large hole in front of me. But, luckily the next morning went back for a little peek and was able to take in the majesty without sort of, looking into a blizzard.
Fun fact, do you know how many Grand Canyons would fit inside the Grand Canyon?
What? You don't know. You must have had to look this up. Is this something you know?
Is this Rumpelstiltskin I'm talking to right now? What sort of riddle is this? Is this our first question? Do I buzz in with my name?
Just the one. I mean, it's used as the sort of meter stick for everything else, but that is in exactly one Grand Canyon, did you know?
Fits in the Grand Canyon.
Oh, wow, okay.
More if you sort of squeeze them in and pack them vertically.
Yeah. All right. Well, if I fit a bowl into a bowl, there'd still be a little overhang. So I reckon 90% of a Grand Canyon would fit in the Grand Canyon.
Well, baby, you're mine.
Just out early with the points before we even start.
No.
The rules.
Are loose, are they?
Let me get to the rules. They're very, very loose. You might get a chance to steal an answer. Only when I'd say it's okay. There are no buzzers. I decide the points. Veronica Milsom, a question for you about the Canberra bubble, the secret ministries, which sounds like one of those like sordid cults Netflix style shows.
Sounds like a Harry Potter novel. That's what I'm excited about. Yeah.
The secret ministries of former Prime Minister Scott Morrison continue to make headlines today. The government said it would adopt the recommendations of the Bell Inquiry to stop this ever happening again. But which former minister in Scott Morrison's cabinet broke their long silence on the matter today, calling the move an extreme overreach? A, former Health Minister Greg Hunt. B, former Treasurer Josh Frydenberg. Or C, former Home Affairs Minister Karen Andrews?
Oh, well, I mean, it was, I know the answer, but I know how quizzes work. So you pretend you don't know the answer and you're working towards it.
You don't know me.
I mean, it's the guy who nobody's heard from for a while because he got a bit disgraced at the old election. Frydenberg, eh?
Oh, yes!
Lovely to hear from him again.
Yes!
The former treasurer told veteran journalist Nikki Sava that he felt betrayed by the former prime minister's actions, and it would appear as if there had been no apology in return. So this is some mean girls stuff on a federal level, isn't it?
And then because Scott Morrison did that Facebook post where he refused to say sorry. Well, he just didn't, did he? Yeah.
They really have truly broken up now. Very well done, Veronica. Several federal politicians, Alex, have renewed their push to lower Australia's voting age to 16 this week. But where in the world was the voting age of 18 ruled discriminatory and breached the human rights of young people this week? Was it A, Norway, B, the Netherlands, or C, New Zealand?
I tell you what, it did come up during my little independent campaign at the election. You know, talking to a few young people, they were a bit disappointed they got left out. And I think the courts in New Zealand sided with their young people and said, that 18 was not a good cutoff.
Ooh.
There we go. That's quite interesting. Because when I was... Sorry.
Let me get the sound effect out, mate. Come on.
Classic politician in buddy question time there, just shouting over one another. But, yeah, why is 16 considered right? Because when we were pontificating about it, I thought as soon as you start paying income tax, maybe that could be a time where you get a bit of a say as to where your funds end up going.
Yeah, in fact, earlier this week I interviewed the Make It 16 campaign in New Zealand, and they have this great little lines calling it, you know, taxation without representation, which is pretty powerful. You know, she put a very good argument on the table. What do you think? Should 16-year-olds be empowered with the most hallowed ritual of democratic rights?
It feels to me like it would just favour people who had kids, because I would only ever have just done what my parents did, right? So it just means you get a double vote for a couple of years.
I didn't think of it like that.
But maybe that's probably not the case. Lots of 16-year-olds are like, shut up, Mom, or whatever.
There are a few people wandering in who openly said that they weren't taking their vote seriously and they were a lot older than 16. So there may be a couple of donkeys coming out from the 16-year-olds, but also, that happens at every age, I think, these days as well.
Would it end up a bit like the school council elections where a candidate gets up and says, I think we should have Fridays off and not have to wear uniforms and play Halo?
Yeah, lemonade from the bubbler,
That's it.
Okay, Veronica, let's take off. Let's head around the world for some international news. A dopey story from India. Police in the state of Uttar Pradesh have had to explain to a court why they couldn't produce hundreds of kilos of seized cannabis. Now, they laid blame on, the tiny hands and feet of rats and rodents for supposedly eating almost 200 kilos.
Whoa.
What did the judge subsequently order? A, that each police station was to employ multiple cats to catch the rats. B, every single police officer in the state be drug tested weekly for the next 2 years. Or C, the remaining cannabis be auctioned off to research labs and medical firms.
I think cats to get the rats because that's the way we always go. You just got to, if you want to get rid of one species, you just get a bigger one that's going to cause a bigger problem. Then they'll need something else to eat the cats, dogs to eat the cats, and so on and so on.
Then cane toads get brought in. And,
exactly.
Yeah. No.
Oh,
So, Alex, is it drug testing for all the cops in India, or is it auctioning off the remaining cannabis for research?
They'd have to subject them to drug tests, maybe.
No.
So according to the BBC, the judge said the only way to protect the sea's goods from such fearless mice, which sounds like an origin story of some sort of new superhero movie, was to auction the drugs to research labs and medicine firms, with the proceeds going to the government. So the government is effectively a weed dealer in India.
And how long do they hang on to it?
I'm not privy to all the details.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's weird.
All I do is rhyme cats and rats. I got nothing else.
Well done. I tip my hat.
About that.
With the scores levelled, Alex, to you, a question that is out of this world. I need you to tell me who said this week, people will be living and working on the moon by 2030. Was it A, NASA, B, Elon Musk, or C, Richard Branson?
NASA, Elon Musk, or Richard Branson. Okay. Which one of those people would I want as my stepdad?
call me NASA, not daddy.
You know what? I'm going to go with NASA.
Why?
Because I've been seeing other people, well, particularly one of them, tweet lots of various different things, and I think that would be too easy. And I did hear that Joe Biden was interested in moon at one point. I reckon could be a little bit of a red herring rocket going up to the moon.
Excellent logic.
Oh, yes! Right. You're
well right. NASA's lead on its current Orion moon mission, Howard Hu, told the BBC, certainly in this decade we're going to have people living for durations, depending on how long we will be on the surface. So it depends on if you've got a return ticket and, you know, if you've got an accommodation booked. They will have habitats. There'll be rovers on the ground. We are going to be sending people down to the surface, and they're going to be living on that surface and doing science.
It's just not true. It just won't happen. And plus, it's making people feel like less anxious about climate change. I feel like we should remain anxious about Planet A.
That's a good point.
Well, I tell you what, working up there, you'd be pretty stressed. You'd imagine going to work in a bloody moon commute. That would be very, very rough. Although, for people who have to go down Punt Road in Melbourne, it'd probably be a bit shorter even.
Mm.
Hang on. NASA do research, and the Indian government gave weed to Howard Hu is definitely on the Uttar Pradesh cannabis. That's an interesting statement. Doing science.
I saw a fact that the Indian space mission, I think, to the moon cost less than the actual movie Gravity, which was about being in space. So there's a little. Do I get a bonus point for that?
Someone fact check that. He could just make that up.
I mean, it sounds good, though, right?
I thought he was going to make a joke about weed on the moon. That's what I was ready for. And I was like, get me there.
If you can come up with a fast fact now about anything at all, you can get a point, just to be fair.
Oh my gosh, I actually know lots of facts about reef-related animals because of the show. What's a great one? The stargazing fish likes to weasel its way down into the sand, and then it can spit this like oil stuff into the air, and then it waits for fish to pass, and then it quickly jumps up and grabs them.
Yes. You have to give it to her.
Yeah. That was, trust all of Veronica's facts to be about reefer.
Yeah. It's not reef, it's reefer. Ow.
Okay, this is the Who Am I round. V, if you use up too many clues, you don't get any point. I never have a good way to describe this, but essentially, the more efficient you are with the clues, the more points you get.
Okay.
Who am I? I was born in Europe, 1985. I'm 37.
Oh, Europe, 1985.
So. Another three clues available to you, good self.
Oh, I mean, that's ridiculous. Yeah, I need another one.
I'm a professional footballer.
Oh, what? I don't know stuff like this. I just know the name like Ronaldo. Oh.
What? In the parlance of the fourth grade, you have picked it like a dirty nose. The other clues were, this week I walked out on my principal employer in England, and the last clue was, in happier news, I also became the first male player to score at five different World Cups with my country, my team from the country, Portugal.
Wow. Okay. So that was what made it news related.
That was made it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, good. Well done me. Stab in the dark.
First with the reef trivia, now pulling ahead in the points. Alex, it's up to you. Who am I?
This is going to be tough. All right.
I am not Cristiano Ronaldo. I was born in Queensland. I'm also 37 years of age, though.
Oh. If I guess, do I get more guesses as we go along? Do you get one guess per one? Or you got to save it up?
You've got to commit.
I've got an umpire putting their middle finger to the air in the number one out there, so I might have to save my guess and go one more.
Okay. I showed promise as an athlete at several sports at a young age.
A Queenslander, 37, who showed
promise at
sports.
Do you know anyone like that? Anyone at all?
Matt O'Kine.
Yes.
Some very impressive work tonight. Very efficient clue handling. Of course, the other clue was that I worked at many different sections of the Australian entertainment industry. And this week, the ABC announced I'm spearheading the reboot of the beloved TV show Mother and Son with Denise Scott, which is going to be cracker.
Yeah, isn't it? I need to familiarise myself with the original.
Well, you had Ruth Cracknell.
Mm.
You had Zepps. The uncle, you had Norman.
Gary McDonald. And you do need to familiarise yourself with the old one, because how else are you going to claim that the new one's so much worse without knowing the old one? I guess most people could do it anyway. But how about that? My podcast co-host did the news for that as well.
Yeah.
I thought if one of the clues was he's got a small bump at the very bottom of his back that one could say is a tail.
That could be
another fact that probably would have led me over to. We did that on radio at one point.
That is a pretty, I wouldn't say fun fact, but it's certainly very interesting. You obviously know each other very intimately, which is beautiful.
Can I give you a fun fact about my body? I have a birthmark on my tummy and my bottom, same one exactly as my mum.
Oh!
Give me a point.
What?
No. We're not allowed to say bottom. I'm sorry.
Isn't that crazy, though?
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're matching.
Yeah, we have matching bodies.
That is
wild, hey?
Amazing.
Mm.
You are in the lead, so I didn't want to, give you too much.
Okay.
The music round, we take a few songs, we smash them together, they point to a story that has been in the news this week, hence the whole point of this quiz. Veronica, take a listen.
It's Thanksgiving Day, and the people have gathered to break bread. 99 red balloons floating in the summer sky.
Well, so I it's about a news story that's related to those three. Okay, let me talk you through the fact that this was the biggest news in ABC Kids, where I work. Everybody's very excited about this. For the Thanksgiving parade, the Macy's one, if we're allowed to say that, there was a big balloon and it was of Bluey.
Pretty impressive stuff. I mean, little old humble Bluey coming out of your nation's public broadcaster, getting blown up to this X 100 times and marching in the Thanksgiving Day parade.
Yeah, I think I never believed how big Bluey was overseas. You'd read the articles of people being like, oh, my kid now speaks with an Australian accent in America. And I'd be like, well, it feels like just a couple of people. And then you go, oh, wow. And Fallon had, the two main actors on. It's pretty crazy.
In fact, Dave McCormack and Melanie Zanetti met for the first time. So the parents this week, the parents, Bluey's parents, Bandit and Chili, only because it's just recorded in isolation. So they met for the first time this week. Pretty amazing. So, and they packed out, was it Madison Square Garden with the live show? Incredible stuff.
Goodness. Wild, yeah.
Tell you what, forget investing in crypto. If you want to make some money, invest in stories about Australian cattle dogs. You got Red Dog, you got Bluey. Whoever's got the next one, it's
reef bloody school, mate.
Reef school.
What? Yeah, there's a dog underwater. I wouldn't like to see that at all.
Going
to
see a giant, terrifying, blown up Veronica Milsom being floated down. The street.
I love that.
Alex, here are your musical clues. What story from the week do they allude to? Take a listen.
I want to take you back. I got to show you. Aria, aria, aria. Everybody get up. Sing it. Make you get down now. Ooh, you got me feeling myself. Now I put it on you.
haven't I? Bit of a musical story here, obviously, but also a bit of a story of celebration. What do you think it's about?
Well, I hadn't heard the first song before, but there was a little bit of an aria, aria, aria. Then there was a band, which is, I think, touring Australia in the next month. Five. They're coming with 3 members. False advertising, if you ask me. And then I heard a little bit of the Fresh Prince of Arnhem Land, Baker Boy. It can only be the Denzel himself taking up 5 arias.
Yes. Baker Boy Incredible. Lit up the ARIA Awards, 5 awards, including Album of the Year and Best Hip Hop Rap Release for his album, Geller.
Yeah, Ooh. I hadn't listened to it before. This is what happens once you leave Triple J. I hadn't heard the full album, so I quickly listened to it this morning. I was like, whoop, catch up.
Now you know what it feels like to be me for the last 20 years.
Yeah, sure.
Like, what is this on Triple J? Who is this? Just made up words and letters.
Yeah.
But always a pleasure to hear new music on the nation's public broadcaster. As I take out the genuine 1974 Casio calculator, little bit of paper at the top. It's actually a sound effect, but no surprises here. The winner tonight.
Come on.
6 points.
Yes.
Is Alex Dyson.
What?
How did we manage that?
Maybe it was the moles that I marked you down for.
No, you did not. You took off marks. It wasn't moles, it was birthmarks.
You can have another one.
Hey! I planned my victory music. You win again from the very beginning.
Very good. Alex, you're cooking up all-day breakfasts with Matt O'Kine wherever you get your fine podcasts. Congratulations on taking out the RN Drive Friday quiz, my friend.
Oh, thanks very much. I'm going to have a pep in my step going into our Monday morning pod with Matty. Now that he was a question in this, it's always very exciting.
And V, your latest podcast is about fast fashion called Threads and available now through the ABC Listen app. And, Reef School, starring some of Australia's most famous voices on ABC Kids TV. Can't wait for that to take over our household when it comes out.
Big balloon. Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Great to see you both. Have a nice weekend.
Whee! You too.
Welcome back. You're with Andy Park and this is RN Drive. Well, the Seekers were perhaps the first Australian band to truly capture the world stage, even dislodging the Beatles and the Rolling Stones from their positions at the top of the charts. In the drawing room tonight, you'll be joined by one of the band's founding members, Keith Potker, to look back at the band's 60th anniversary and share some very raw and very emotional memories of his dearly missed bandmate, Judith Durham. That's coming up in 10 minutes on air, online and on the ABC Listen app. You're listening to RN Drive across Australia. I'm Andy Park. Now, there's new research that shows a woman's brain changes after pregnancy, but rather than being sort of baby brain and maybe that being a kind of negative connotation, maybe it's a good thing. Let's find out. Dr. Leela Landowski is a neuroscientist with the University of Tasmania. Great to have you back, Leela. Tell me about this research, because certainly it is that sort of derogatory tone when you hear baby brain from women and from men as well, having to all deal with the changes after a little one comes into your lives.
So, Andy, I love this study because there was a study that came out a few decades ago that showed that women's brains actually shrink little bit after pregnancy, and people were just like, oh, well, that's a bad thing, you know, and it created some really awful stereotypes and assumptions about, you know, our capacity to do your job after having kids. And what people didn't realize is that this was kind of an adaptive process. It was actually a good thing. So, you know, for example, we know that our brains actually peak in size just before we hit puberty and then they shrink. And it's because these connections in the brain, which take up physical space, they get refined. And as it becomes refined, it shrinks a little bit. So we become able to do those things more effectively. So after that study came out, people made negative assumptions about women's brains, and you know, I thought that shrinking was bad, but they were looking at the problem wrong. And I guess it brings us to this study, and I love this study because it shows us things in a more positive light again. So you know, this study was out of, I think it was out of the Netherlands, and they showed that women who had this increase in connections in part of the brain called the default mode network, and that went back down to normal about a year after the baby was born. And it's part of this amazing adaptive process that happens during pregnancy.
So in actual fact, the symptoms of quote-unquote baby brain are actually signs of great changes. And what replaces it? What sort of neural networks or brain changes follow this kind of period of baby brain?
Yeah, well, look, we know that we've got this change in the default mode network activity, and we know scientists haven't quite settled on what this brain network does, but we know it's, you know, active when you're observing things around you or contemplating things in your life, and that can be a really useful thing because it's helping you reframe your sense of self and your new identity as a mother, and it's helping you bond with the baby. And other research has shown that there's this increase in activity of parts of the brain involved in social connection. So having a baby supercharges your brain and your ability to read social situations and to understand what other people are feeling. And I think that's really important because, you know, you have to figure out why your baby's crying. They can't tell you, so you need to figure it out what they might need. So we need to get rid of this idea that pregnancy is impairing us. Yes, you might be a bit more forgetful, it's because of the sleep deprivation, not the actual pregnancy
itself.
Yeah,
I was going to say, so what's my excuse when I had baby brain after my children? There was nothing biological going on. It was just out-and-out bone tiredness. Neuroscientist Dr. Lila Landowski is here. We're talking about brains on RN Drive. You're with Andy Park. And if you think kids absorb new information faster than you do, a new study in current biology research proves that you're right. So I'll ask you, Lila, why do children pick up new information faster than me?
Oh, it's so annoying how they learn so quickly. Look, so there's this new research out of Germany, and that has some really useful clues about what's going on. So we already knew, for example, that kids' brains are more primed for neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity is this idea that is our brain's ability to change and adapt and learn in response to the experiences that we have in life. So they have lots of extra connections in the brain, which definitely has something to do with it. And you can kind of think of it as they have lots of extra places to store information. But what this new study does is it shows us a little bit more about how it does that. So when kids are learning, not the first time they try to learn, but the second time, so specifically after they've repeated the thing that they're trying to learn, they have this rapid increase in a chemical in the brain called GABA. But the adults, you know, we don't have that same increase.
GABA. Okay. So they've got the benefit of a bit of GABA going on, makes them a little bit, faster to pick up new skills. So why is there a rapid boost in GABA only after the second time children try to learn? And what's going on in the brain of a child at that moment?
Oh, great question. Look, so the brain doesn't want to change itself every time you do something different. People have this this false assumption that, you know, our brain's really plastic and adaptable, and if we tie our shoelaces in a weird way, it's going to change our brain. But that's not the reality. So learning takes a lot of energy, and the brain physically has to change all of these tiny connections. And the brain's not going to waste energy in changing itself if you've only done a thing once. So that's why repetition is so important for learning. And that's why we see this significant change in those brain chemicals the second time they've practiced the task, but not the first time. And in terms of what GABA's doing, look, it's what we call an inhibitory neurotransmitter. But look, what it seems to be doing is it's stabilizing that new information that's learnt. And because adults don't have as much of it, that new information isn't as stable. And what that really means in practical terms is it makes it really easy to lose that information, to kind of overwrite those memories and that knowledge. And that's why it's actually really important to take a break after you've tried to learn something. Because, you know, if you've tried to learn something and you run off and do something else, or you play on your phone, you're actually destabilizing that information in your brain. So it'll be much harder to remember whatever it was that you were trying to do.
You just wait until the wellness industry cottons onto this GABA. There'll be GABA in everything. GABA on your muesli, GABA in your vitamin supplements. This is the thing that we've certainly been missing. Now, moving on, researchers in the US have undertaken a first-of-its-kind randomized clinical trial to see if mindfulness-based stress reduction, or MBSR, is an effective kind of treatment for antidepressant drug-related disorders. So the kinds of symptoms you might relieve yourself of when you're taking antidepressant drugs. Is this true? Can we do mindfulness instead of taking pills?
Oh, I love this study because it was the first to really compare a pill and this kind of this mindfulness. And what they did is they got people to go through this mindfulness-based stress reduction program for 8 weeks. They had this weekly 2.5-hour class. Then they had to do mindfulness at home every day. And their weekly classes did things like they had a body scan. They figured out how different parts of their body felt. They thought about their breathing, all those sorts of things. And they did that for 8 weeks. And the reason why they did it in classes is because people don't really like to do it on their own. They're not really good at adhering to it or doing it properly. So that's why they did it that way. And when they compared it to this drug called escitalopram, also known as Lexapro, if you're taking it in Australia, it's one of these really common drugs that gets used. So it was quite remarkable that the two things were comparable. They were as effective as the drug.
So what kinds of applications could we imagine this to use? I mean, certainly these days there seems to be, an epidemic of anxiety and depression coming out of the pandemic. Where do you think mindfulness might best fit as a kind of treatment in the future?
Look, I think there's always a place for medications. If you're already taking medication, certainly, explore that with your doctor and talk about the option of maybe whether having this mindfulness and meditation is something for you and trying it together. But I think it's relevant to all of us. You know, life is full of anxiety-provoking things that we can't control. And this is a way that, you know, each and every one of us might have the opportunity to potentially reduce anxiety in our own lives.
Very good. I'm going to take up some mindfulness this weekend. Dr. Lila Landowski is a neuroscientist from the University of Tasmania. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much.
You're with Andy Park. This is RN Drive. Time now for The Drawing Room.
Drawing Room, over here.
You made it. Oh, come on through. Do you fancy drink? What's your tipple? Welcome to The Drawing Room, a space for intimate and surprising conversations. I'm Andy Park. It's been 60 years since the Seekers first came together and began making the music that became beloved by a generation of fans. When Judith Durham, the band singer, passed away sadly in August this year, she was honoured with a state memorial service, a symbol of just how much their music has meant to Australians over the years. Keith Potker is one of the founding members of the Seekers, and Keith is my guest, dressed up to the nines, I've got to say. We don't often get such flashy dresses here in the drawing room. Keith, welcome to you.
Oh, thank you, Andy, and hello to your listeners.
Take me back to what was going on as the Seekers were first starting out. What was happening in music around you at the time? What was inspiring you? What were you listening to?
Well, it was 1962, as you said, 60 years, and the folk boom was happening around, particularly in Melbourne, as it turned out. Sydney was the kind of rock and roll capital, and Melbourne was folky orientated. And we, as the nascent Seekers, were mightily impressed by people, especially like the Weavers. And the Weavers contained Pete Seeger, and Pete Seeger was a big hero to me and to Bruce Woodley because of his wonderful banjo playing, and he inspired us. And that lineup of the Weavers with a girl singer, Ronnie Gilbert, and three blokes was pretty much the way we developed as a girl and three blokes. And that was what was happening in Australia. And so we were doing our little coffee lounge gigs in Melbourne and doing the odd concert here and there and the odd television show. But it was very low key, and it was kind of Melbourne-centric in those days.
Melbourne-centric, but also there was the Californian sound. How much was the horse before the cart in terms of people being inspired here versus what was happening across the Pacific?
Well, the California sound happened a little bit later. And it was really when we had, or after we'd arrived in England, that that became rather more predominant, and we were influenced then by people like the Mamas and Papas, etc. And the New York sound was, of course, another thing, which was Peter, Paul and Mary, talking about groups anyway, and solo singers, Bob Dylan. So who can, you know, who can overlook those sorts of people? But when we were starting off, I think it was very much the folky folkies, you know, like the Woody Guthries and people like that, who were predominant in our inspiration and our influences.
How did a Seekers song come together? What was your process?
It was very straightforward in the sense that all four of us had to agree that that was a song.
Very democratic.
Oh, totally. And we stuck with that principle all the way through. And then any of us would present a song. And at that stage, none of us was writing a song to go into the mix. But I kicked off with a couple of folk songs, and then Bruce started writing some original songs. So it was that process where we presented our material, and I had an idea, and someone else had an idea, etc. And then it would go to the committee, and we would then decide that that was the song that we were going to do, and there were plenty of cast-offs.
Of course, it's easy to imagine the transition from the band forming to the first big success with a sort of Hollywood fade to black in between. But yep, there must have been a lot of hard work in between. What were those first few years like? Was it scraping together a few pennies? How did that feel for you?
Well, it was a remarkable process, Andy, because I've got to say, Athol has a phrase for it, and he says you couldn't have planned this in any way, and it really did turn out that way. That we certainly put in some hard yards, but nevertheless, you know, we were in what seems to have been the right place at the right time to have taken advantage of whatever work that we had done. And one of the big advantages I think we had was that we were self-contained in an acoustic fashion. So there was a remarkable occasion when we were doing a concert and the PA system failed, and we had to stand on the front of the stage and perform acoustically. And that was something that a lot of other acts would not have been able, especially groups, I mean solo performers maybe, but not a lot of other groups may have been able to do that.
That's what we call in entertainment more broadly, making a feature of it. When there's a massive failure, you suddenly pretend that it was all meant to be. And, exactly, and it became a thing. Like certainly there's, even today, the folk acts that I see, there's always going to be a part where that's acoustic towards the, semi-acoustic towards end of the set.
Yeah.
So from Melbourne cafes to London and Abbey Road studios, when you first set foot inside that studio with all the history there, what went through your mind?
Oh, it was mind-blowing. And we have to thank our wonderful mentor and record producer and songwriter, Tom Springfield, for that, who coincidentally, I don't know whether that's the right word, died 10 days before Judith died. It's extraordinary. And he's a dear friend to all of us. I particularly kept in touch with him, but he had the song, I'll Never Find Another You. I did the arrangement. We had rehearsed it outside the Abbey Road studios, and we went into the studio. And it was a funny thing for the recording session. Judith was staying with her sister in West Kensington, and she slept in. And the session was about to start. We were a bit early, and I said, "Where's Judith?" And anyway, I had to send a cab round, and she was frightfully apologetic about that. First of all, for sleeping in, but secondly, putting the group to the expense of having to hire a cab for her to bring her to the studio. So
it'll come out of your profits.
totally, yes. And that was our first experience of Abbey Road Studios. And we worked with a wonderful engineer, Norman Smith, the dear man. He became known in his own right as Hurricane Smith later on. And he was a fantastic engineer. But those were the, to us anyway, the golden days of Abbey Road.
So from quibbling over the cost of a cab, then when the Seekers arrived, you truly arrived. You had 6 top 10 hits over 2 years and were competing with the Beatles. That must have been just blow me down with a feather kind of stuff.
Well, it was extraordinary because we were paralleling them. We weren't actually competing. I mean, people say, oh, you know, we knocked the Beatles off the top. You know, and, of course, what happened was our fans knocked the Beatles off the top, you know. And so our fans bought our records in sufficient quantities to compete with the Beatles fans or the Rolling Stones fans. And that was mind-blowing to us. And I've got to say that our fans appear to be still with us, you know, 60 years on. Fantastic.
When you went on the road, especially during the tour in the 60s, was it all screaming fans and limousines or something a bit more sedate, a bit more appreciative, a bit more mature?
Oh, it was very down home, I've got to say, because, you know, I can remember doing a tour of Ireland where we were driven in an Austin A40 to the gig, and it had been raining quite heavily. So when we got out of the car, we had to wade through ankle deep water to get to the venue, and the venue there was no stage door. I mean, there was no backstage. We just walked straight out of the car into a side door of the venue and straight onto the stage. It was only later that we had some element of being able to choose the venues and things like that. But those early days, we were there and doing our job.
On ABCRN, I'm Andy Park. Keith Potger is here. He's from the Seekers. He's my guest in the drawing room. We're about to hear Carry Me. It's a new release for the Seekers, although perhaps not a new song. Tell me about this song. What does it mean for you?
Well, it means a lot to me because it has become the last recording officially that the Seekers have done together. And it started life as long ago as 1995 when Bruce Woodley wrote the song and Judith Durham did a demo of it back in that day. And it lay in the archives until very early this year when historian and dear friend Graham Simpson came across the tape again, or a cassette of it or something, and he said, oh, that sounds like a pretty good song. I wonder whatever happened to it. And luckily, Michael Cristiano, our record producer, had the original multi-track tape. So he was able to extract Judith's vocal from it, and pristine as it was in those, and just remarkable. And with the wonders of digital recording, Athel and Bruce and I put our harmonies on it and put our instruments on it. And Michael added some other instruments and produced the track. So in April of this year, in other words, a few months before Judith died, we had the finished product. And we played it to Judith and she was absolutely blown away. She was absolutely blown away. And it was just fantastic that she had the chance to hear what resulted as our last song together.
Well, as we think back and look back on the late, great Judith Durham, this is Carry Me, the Seekers, here in the drawing room.
So now the bird has flown, begins the mystery. You're on your journey home. Your words of wisdom come to me. Through all the years of doubt, the rhymes and harmony, all the secrets of the heart, I will miss your kindness.
That was The Seekers with Carry Me. It's the title track off their recent Diamond Jubilee collection, also titled Carry Me. Keith Potker from the band is my guest here in the drawing room. Of course, Keith, your friend and bandmate Judith Durham passed away in August this year. So sorry for your loss.
Mm. Thank you.
When you think about the versions of The Seekers over the next few decades, what was it like when you came back together in 1992 after spending so many years apart?
Well, there was a seminal moment when we did get back together in it was in August of 1992 that we decided to regroup, and it was just a wonderful occasion. We went into a little recording studio in South Yarra, and I had my 12-string guitar with me, and just plunked away the opening riff of "I'll Never Find Another You," and we just started singing. And I'm going to say it was just like those 25 years that we had not been a group just vanished. And it was quite an extraordinary thing. And I've still got the recording of it, actually. I had my little cassette machine going. And it was a remarkable get-together. And then after that, we started making plans for some more recording, and we did a couple of new tracks. And then in early 1993, we got on the road again. And really, we didn't stop from 1993 until 2014 when we did our last tours together. It was great.
I always ask my musical guests to give us a peek inside their collection. Tonight, you've chosen Carnival Is Over. Tell me about this song.
Well, for two reasons, or maybe about 1,000 reasons, really. One is that it represents a song that Tom Springfield brought to us after we'd had two hits of his, I'll Never Find Another You, in early 1965, and then followed up by World of Our Own. And we were looking for a song to follow those two hits. And the record company was really anxious for us to keep an upbeat mood going into the Christmas time of 1965. And when Tom brought us this song, we just all loved it so much that we prevailed upon the recording company and said, "Look, this is the song. It's got to be our next single," and it did, and it's become one of the biggest selling singles in UK history, and it means a huge amount of it. So that's the one. The second is that it's my favourite of the Seeker songs, and I should add a third, is that I'm getting a bit emotional here. Is that it's a great tribute to Tom Springfield that he brought us those incredible hits. It really is.
Bit of loss in your community this year.
Oh.
I'm sure it's been quite a year for you in the
city. It has been indeed, yeah, incalculable. But having said that, Athol Bruce and I are now, I've mentioned this a few times now, but we are actually recollecting those incredibly happy times that we've had with Judith.
A good chance to think back and bring those memories back.
Very much.
Carnival Is Over. It's the Seekers here in the Drawing Room.
Say goodbye, my own true lover, as we sing a lover's song. How it breaks my heart to leave you. Now the carnival is gone.
High above, the dawn is waking, and my tears are falling rain. For the carnival is over, we may never meet again.
Like a drum, my heart was beating, and your kiss was sweet as wine.
Keith Potker has been my guest in the Drawing Room. That's Carnival's Over, The Seekers, as chosen by the man himself. He's sitting here in front of me looking very dapper, I've got to say, heading out to the Arias tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure to hear some of your stories and to listen back to the music that made The Seekers so, so great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Andy. It's been my pleasure.
Keith Potker has been my guest in the Drawing Room. And Carry Me, the 60th anniversary album by The Seekers, is out now. And that's all for the show this week. Thanks to my team, Delia Bell, Oscar Coleman, Nicole Hegarty, Sky Kirkham, Lara Sonnenschein, Joe Sullivan, and my EP this week, Katie Hammond and Eleni Soltis. I'm Andy Park. I'll be back on Monday from 6. Bye from now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.